talk is about Bell's theorem and communication complexity. And both subject areas concern the communication costs for performing various feats involving in the context of quantum and classical information, and they're in distributing settings, and I'll explain them in due course. But before getting into that, I'd like to just get in, discuss some preliminary issues that I think might be helpful for my talk, but also just in order to get an appreciation for quantum information in general. And I'd like to first ask the question, if you have n qubits, how much information do they contain? Remember that as Mike Nielsen introduced the model on Monday, and other people discussed it, to write down the state of an n-qubit system, there are 2 to the n kets. It's a 2 to the n dimensional vector. So you have 2 to the n amplitudes. Each would be a complex number. Now, there are some restrictions because the sums of the magnitudes of all of them has to add up to 1. So you actually, it's in terms of the number of degrees of freedom, it amounts to 2 to the n minus 1 complex numbers. That's a lot of data. So to classically write down an n-qubit state, it seems to require a lot of information. Does this mean that an exponential amount of information is contained in n-qubits? Maybe that's how quantum computers work. The answer is no. In fact, it can be made quite formal, and it was known for quite some time. Halevo in 73 proved something that implies that you can never extract more than n classical bits from n quantum bits. So for the purposes of building a memory or something and storing information, even though there are lots of quantum states that sort of are bigger, the set of quantum states is much bigger than the set of classical states, you can't use that if your goal is to somehow store more than n classical bits in n quantum bits. So that might make, if you're skeptical about the validity of the model, if you think it cheats, it might make it seem a little less disconcerting. Also, it might be useful to bear in mind that having objects which require exponentially many numbers to describe are not, they're not, they do occur. For example, if you have n classical bits and they exist in some probabilistic state, if you just use classical randomness, then the probability distribution on n classical bits would be 2 to the n minus 1 real numbers. So that's in general, that's exponential, an exponential amount of information, but most people don't think it's unreasonable to take n bits and put them into some probabilistic state. Let's talk about information not from the point of view of storage and retrieval, but from the point of view of, put it on this side, of communicating. So let's consider this very simple communication scenario. Two parties, we've met a few times this week, Alice and Bob. And Alice has n classical bits. And the goal is to convey those n classical bits to Bob. And there are various kinds of resources that we can endow them with, and look at how much it would cost. Well, the simplest setting is, well, just to get started along these lines, if you allow them to communicate by sending classical bits back and forth, then, well, n bits would be necessary in general to solve this problem if it was uniformly distributed. And, well, communication, we could think of it as being allowed to go in both directions. In this context, it doesn't help for Bob to send a bit back to Alice, of course. But that's the cost in the classical setting. It's perhaps trivial. So what if they're allowed to send quantum bits back and forth, qubits? Well, from Halevo's theorem, which I just referred to a little while ago, you can also get the result that you still have to, the communication cost is still n. So in this particular setting, using qubits instead of classical bits doesn't really buy you anything extra. If you're interested in cryptographic security against an eavesdropper, then as Gilles Bassard referred to this morning and yesterday afternoon, you do get some extra benefit from using quantum information. And, you know, if you want to factor a large number, it's helpful, perhaps. But for communication, it seems like it doesn't get you anything. Maybe I should introduce you to my coloring scheme. I'm highlighting classical information by using the color blue, and when something is quantum, I use the color purple. Now, there are other kinds of quantum resources we can give Alice and Bob. We can give them entanglement. So Mike Nielsen talked about that on Monday, and Gilles mentioned it a little while ago. So if you have two qubits, like let's think of these purple boxes. Each of them contains some device that contains a qubit. So the two things together, they comprise a two-qubit system. So their joint state is given by four-dimensional vector. Can be described that way. Now, in some cases, you can the state can be factored into the tensor product of two states, which means that you can understand the system by just understanding the state of the first qubit and the state of the second qubit. But if they're entangled, such as being in this Bell state or EPR state, then there isn't really a way to decompose the system so that you can just consider the two qubits independently. There is some kind of entanglement or quantum correlation that in some ways means that it's hard to think of the individual systems independently. And some weird things can happen. Just to sort of gradually get towards that, imagine that the two systems are physically very far apart, so that it's not trivial, we wouldn't expect some action at a distance, as referred to earlier. We're doing something here, you know, shouldn't affect something right away on one of the outer planets or in another galaxy. So what happens, let's consider the following setting. Suppose Alice and Bob each have one of these qubits and they're entangled. Then this is the state, and if they both perform a measurement, then with 50% probability they'll both get a result of 0, and with 50% probability they'll both get a result of 1. Okay. Now before they perform the measurement, the result is undetermined. What happens if Alice measures her qubit and Bob doesn't measure his? Well, 50% of the time Alice will get a 0, and 50% of the time she'll get a 1. And when Alice gets a 0, if Bob were to measure later, or before in fact, then he'll get always the state 0. So in fact, if you do the math, then what actually happens is that Bob's state becomes, if Alice this is a measurement result of 0, then Bob's state becomes 0, so it becomes determined if he measures in the computational basis later on. And if Alice gets a 1, then Bob's state becomes a 1. So, well, at least it feels, in some sense, that something's going on, because it feels like Bob's state is changing in a way, because it becomes determined after Alice performs the measurement. But we have to be careful about whether that really means action at a distance in some way, because from Bob's point of view, if Alice doesn't send the result of her measurement, then nothing really changes. Because if you try to imagine any measurement that Bob could perform on his qubit, the result of that measurement wouldn't be affected by whether Alice measures or not. It would still be a 50. Well, if you just did a simple measurement, it would be a 50% chance of 0 or 1, or in any other more complicated quantum operation and measurement wouldn't. There would be no detectable difference. So in another sense, nothing is really happening to Bob's qubit that changes. It's only that Alice gets some knowledge about the outcome of Bob's state. Another thing to note is this effect can't be used to communicate. So if the goal is to use this property of entanglement to somehow for Alice to send a bit to Bob, or maybe to send a fraction of a bit, it can't be done. But Well, anticipating that entanglement will actually make some differences, we can think about incorporating entanglement into the communication scenario. So we could give Alice and Bob some sort of a priori entangled states. So each of these, in this case, they have three qubits. They have three states like this. So this state is entangled with this one, and this with this one. Now, just with this entanglement alone, because of what I just said, there's no way that can be used for Alice to convey her bits to Bob without any communication. But maybe if you combine classical communication with this entanglement, we could hope for some improvement, that maybe Alice can just send n minus 1 classical bits, and somehow using that in conjunction with the entanglement, there could be some savings in communication, maybe just one bit. The answer is, again, no, as is written here. And that can also be deduced from Holleben's theorem, that there's actually no savings whatsoever in communication by having this a priori entanglement. So it doesn't look very promising so far, unless you're hoping that I'll finish by 12, then maybe it looks like I'm on the right track for that. But bad news for you, are you hoping? Another setting we can have is where we sort of give them both. We give them entanglement plus quantum communication. And then there is actually a savings that they can get. And this is the super dense coding that Mike Nielsen talked about on Monday, where basically if they use somehow one Bell state in conjunction with Alice sending Bob one quantum bit, that can be used for Alice to convey two classical bits to Bob. So you may not remember that. It's interesting to remember the results that you get a factor of two savings by using entanglement and quantum communication. Whether that factor of two is significant, well, when you add up the resources, maybe you prefer to send n classical bits instead of having this entanglement and n quantum bits. But nevertheless, there is something that we could claim is an improvement. And that factor of two is optimal, too. Even if you give them lots of an arbitrary entanglement, they can't improve the communication cost by more than a factor of two. So just to summarize, for this communication problem with quantum communication, there is no savings. With classical communication in conjunction with entanglement, there's no savings in communication. And with entanglement and quantum communication, there's this factor of two savings. And we'll look at other tasks where the savings are different. And maybe it's important to know just what I've been discussing, just to get a feeling for what you can't hope to accomplish with quantum information. Charlie?
Before you put that slide away, yeah. The consequence of that, if you didn't have the entanglement, the qubits could go halfway in one direction and halfway in the other direction for just using quantum communication, whereas classically they'd all have to go forward.
Oh, yeah. So in fact, what Mike Nielsen, the example he gave for super-dense coding was one where they didn't have the preset entanglement, but Bob sends a qubit, you might remember, to Alice, and then Alice sends a qubit to Bob, and that's what you're referring to, and that's that you classically, by sending bits that way, you can't do it. Thanks. So now moving right along, Bell's theorem. So it was already alluded to in Jill's talk earlier, and I'm going to explain that Bell's theorem, but before that I'm going to explain another analogous kind of result that's more recent. And I think it's helpful to think about this one first and then Bell's theorem. And this is a result of Greenberger, Horn, and Zeilinger. And it's a three-party scenario where, and I think the way to appreciate this is to think about this as a game. So to understand, it's important to get the the way this game works straight. So let's spend a little bit of time on it. So Alice and Bob and, well, Charlie are a team, and they're trying to win a game. And the way it's going to work is each of them is going to receive one bit. X is a bit, Y is a bit, and Z is a bit as input. And each of them is also required to produce an output bit. Alice will produce A, Bob B, Charlie C. And the rules of the game are that, well, first of all, the input is not an arbitrary three-bit string, but there's some condition, and that is that the parity of the three bits is zero, which means the number of ones in the string is even. So 0, 0, 0 is an input that they can expect might occur, and or 0, 1, 1, but 0, 1, 0 will never occur because that doesn't satisfy this promise. Okay, so that's something that's sort of given that maybe it's helpful to for Alice, Bob, and Charlie to know. Okay, another rule is that after they receive the inputs, we forbid any communication to occur between them. So Alice, in particular, she'll know X, but she won't know Y or Z. If X is 0, then it could be that Y and Z are both 0, or it could be that Y and Z are both 1. And Alice won't know because there's no communication allowed between the parties. And then there's this condition for which we could think of Bob, of the team trying to achieve, and succinctly it can be written this way, that the parity of the three output bits is the logical OR of the three input bits, and what that translates into this table. So these are the four possible input configurations that they can expect to receive. And if the inputs are all 0, well, the logical OR of 0, 0, and 0 is 0, so that means in that case, we want the parity of the three output bits to be 0. And if the inputs are 0, 1, 1, then, well, the logical OR of that, since there's at least 1, 1, is 1, so the parity of the three output bits should be 1, and similarly for these cases. So this basically, this table means the same thing as this equation. Okay, so that's what it means for them to win. And then we're going to explore whether they can, there's a strategy that allows them to win all the time. Okay, does that make sense? Do you understand the game? Now is a good time to stop. So we could spend a little time exploring, you know, what kinds of strategies they might use and what the possibilities are. Let's consider a possible strategy. So since Alice's output, since there's no communication, it can really only depend on her input. So what she could, for example, she could just output whatever her input bit is. And Bob, well, he could output his input bit too, but maybe he could output the negation of his input bit. And Charlie, well, maybe he could always output 1 regardless of what his input. This is a possible strategy. And let's see how well that strategy works. Well, if the three input bits are 0, then Alice is going to output 0. Bob will negate his 0, so he'll output 1, and Charlie will output 1. So the output bits will be 0, 1, 1. And lo and behold, the parity of these three output bits is 0, which is what we want, so they win in that case. Okay, so we could put a tick here. So far, so good. But they have to win in all four cases. So the second case, what happens? Well, Alice will output, the inputs are 0, 1, 1, so Alice will output a 0, Bob will output a 0, negating the 1, and Charlie always outputs a 1. And the parity of these three bits is 1. There's an odd number of 1s. So that case is fine. And just looking at the table, the parity of these three bits is 1, which it should be. So these three cases, so far, so good. But unfortunately, the last case, the strategy fails, because the parity of the three output bits will be 0, whereas we require that they be 1. So this only works 3 out of 4, in 3 out of 4 of the cases. Now, that's one strategy. We might ask, well, maybe there's another strategy, a more clever way to do it, that wins in all four cases. It doesn't take that long to analyze this game, but just to speed things up, what I'll do is actually give a proof that this is the best that they can hope for, is a strategy like this. They can win in any 3 of the 4 cases, in fact, but they can't win in all 4 cases. So they can't force a win. And the idea is that It's basically, the proof is follows from these four equations here. Alice's output can only depend on her input. So you can imagine that there are two parameters, what Alice's output is when her input is 0 and what Alice's output is when her input is 1. So let's call those quantities A0 and A1. And similarly, for Bob, we have B0 and B1, and for Charlie, C0 and C1. And then you can translate these winning conditions into equations. So when all three input bits are 1, the parity of the output bits should be 0. So this equation has to hold. When the input bits are 0, 1, and 1, that's the second row in this table, the parity of the output bits should be 1, so this equation should be satisfied, and so on. So basically, any winning strategy would have to correspond to 6 bits that satisfy these 4 equations. And, well, if you sum the left side and the right side, you get 0 equals 1 if you sum mod 2, because each variable appears twice on the left side, so it cancels. So you can satisfy 3 equations, but not 4. Those are deterministic strategies. The subscript. So A0, so this is sort of representing an arbitrary strategy. And A0 is what A outputs when the input bit that she receives is 0. So in this particular case, A0 is 0 and A1 is 1. Okay, so that's for all deterministic strategies. And, well, in terms of games, you can think about them following a mixed strategy, you know, with random coins, and it turns out that can be translated into winning with probability 3/4. They can sort of hide which equation is the one that's violated, and there's only a 1/4 chance that they'll be unlucky, that will correspond to the input they get. Okay, so the conclusion is that, well, I've just proven that they can't win with more than 75% probability. So suppose that we actually were to play this game. I don't know if we could. It might not be practical to put them on separate planets, but we could put them in separate cells or something, separate rooms, and try to basically make sure they don't have any transmitters on them. And suppose that we did this 10 times and they won every time. Well, that's not. Maybe they got a little bit lucky because, you know, the average would be 7.5 times. Well, suppose they won, you did it 100 times and they won every time. Well, that's a little bit more surprising. How about if you did it 1,000,000 times and they won every time? Well, then you might start to get a little suspicious that something funny is going on here. Because, if you basically believe this proof, it shouldn't be possible for that to happen. So then you might think, well, they could be cheating. So maybe there is some way that Bob is communicating to Alice. So suppose Bob is able to send his bit to Alice, unbeknownst to you. Well, then, if Alice knows X and Y, well, because of this equation, she can deduce Z. So she has all the information about which 4 cases they're in. So if Bob is able to send one bit to Alice, then Bob and Charlie can always output 0, and then Alice can just output the corresponding bit here. So that one bit is one way. One bit communication is a way that they can always force a win. Now, how can you be really sure that they're not communicating? Well, that's where this sort of schematic comes in handy, because you could physically separate them by a really large distance. And you could time things so that they, at least in one inertial reference frame, they all get their inputs at the same time. And you demand that they produce their outputs very shortly afterwards, so that there isn't enough time for Bob to send a signal to Alice without sending it faster than the speed of light. And then if you believe information can't travel faster than the speed of light, then you don't have to really, you should be confident that it's physically impossible for them to be defeating the system by communicating. And suppose you did that, and they also kept winning every time. Well, it turns out that in principle it is possible for them to win every time, and entanglement is used. And this is sometimes, well, it could be called the GHZ theorem, the GHZ inequality, or the GHZ paradox. It's not really a paradox, but it just might seem a little bit surprising. And the way they're able to win every time is by using entanglement. And in this particular case, each of them has a qubit, and the joint state of the 3 qubits is a state, which is a GHZ state. It's actually, some of you may have physicists have seen it in a different way. This is exactly the same as the conventional GH dead state, just in a slightly different basis. There's an interesting kind of entanglement, because it's a tripartite entanglement between three qubits. And if you just look at any two qubits in isolation, they're not entangled with each other. So it's only if you actually look at the three qubit system that you actually the entanglement actually is noticeable. And it might be a bit surprising how they can use entanglement to communicate. I mean, how they can use it to defeat the system. Because if you interpret this as a proof that, and, you know, classically this is a proof that in order to win all the time, there has to be communication among the three parties. This is a system where, using entanglement, they're able to defeat the system. So one might think, well, somehow using the entanglement, they're able to communicate. And that's how they're defeating the, winning the game all the time. But remember what I said before, by entanglement alone can't be used to communicate. And that works when you have bipartite as well as tripartite entanglement. So actually they can't possibly be communicating by using this entanglement. I'll explain in a moment how the actual protocol works. But that reasoning isn't quite right, and I'll get back to that later. But first, let's actually see how the system is broken. So what do the three players do? Well, the protocol is simple to describe. What Alice does is she looks at her input bit, and if her input bit is a 1, then she applies this Hadamard transform, which you remember, to her qubit. So let's say the first qubit is Alice, the second one is Bob, and the third is Charlie. And if her input bit is 0, then she doesn't apply the Hadamard transform, and then after that she measures the qubit, and whatever the result is, that's what she sets A to. So if her input is a 0, she measures right away, and if her input is a 1, then she first applies the Hadamard transform and then measures. So she measures in a different basis. Okay? What do Bob and, well, Carol do? They basically do the same thing. They look at their input. If it's 1, they apply a Hadamard, and if it's 0, they don't, and then they measure. And why does this work? Well, let's suppose all the inputs are 0. I mean, to see that it works, it would be sufficient to go through all of these four cases. We don't really have to go through all four. Let's go through the first one. If all the inputs are 0, then according to this protocol, each of them is just measuring their qubit. They're not applying any of these Hadamard transforms. And if you think about what happens when you measure in this computational basis, the state, well, you're going to get this 0, 0, 0 with probability a quarter, 0, 1, 1 with probability of a quarter, and similarly 1, 0, 1 and 1, 1, 0 with probability of a quarter. Now, in all three cases, the parity of the three bits is 0, so it works for this case. The parity is what it should be at 0. Okay, another case where suppose then the inputs are 0, 1, and 1. Then that means that before the measurement occurs, there's going to be a Hadamard transform applied to this qubit and to this one. And if you do a little calculation, you'll see that applying a Hadamard transform to the second two qubits at this state gives you this state. And now, if you look at each ket here, there are an odd number of ones. So when you perform the measurement, you get something where the parity is 1. So this case works fine. And then the other cases are similar to the second one. Okay? Now note, actually, is there any communication occurring? Well, what actually Alice gets, it's just a random bit. It's going to be 50% chance of being 0 or 50% chance of being 1, and in this case also. So actually, it's only in the correlation that something is happening, but there's no information, there's no communication occurring. And so what entanglement is doing is it's not simulating communication, but it's just sort of doing something else that allows this game to be won. It's circumventing communication. Yes? That's right. That's right. And I think, but that's if they use a mixed strategy, a probabilistic strategy, then that could be that could involve having classical shared information. So you're quite right. If they use
this is really your experiment to describe something. Oh well, they just got together beforehand and decided on some strategy. That's not going to explain the result. It's just very exciting.
Yeah, they got together and they shared some entanglement, and that enabled them to win. But in terms of, if they only use classical information, then this basically, this no-go proof holds, and they can't win with probability more than 3/4. So in terms of just using classical information, they can win with probability at most 3/4, and with quantum information, they can win with probability 1. Did I address the point?
Yeah, okay.
And thinking classically, you need communication to win this game all the time, but with quantum information, you can win the game all the time without any communication. Okay. So Bell's theorem is of the similar. Now Bell's theorem is not going to look that strange. I mean, it's a two-party scenario, and we can think of that as a game also. Alice and Bob, they each get an input bit, and they're each required to produce an output bit. And what are the rules here? There's no promise in this case. They can just there are four possibilities: 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. After the inputs are received, there's no communication allowed. And we'll say that they win if the parity of the three outputs is the logical AND of the two input bits, which just corresponds to this table. So if the inputs are 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, or 1, 0, then it should be even parity, and if the inputs are 1, 1, it should be odd parity. Okay? And using classical randomness, if they got together before the game started and flipped some coins, the 75% is the best they can do. So it's really similar to this game in a sense. So that can be proven. And with entanglement, they can do better, although it's not quite as sharp. If you have an EPR pair, a Bell state of entanglement, sometimes they're called EPR pairs, they can't win all the time, but they can win at least quantitatively. They can do better. They can win 85% of the time. So if you had a really large sample of runs, you'd actually notice statistically that there's actually something going on that is very unlikely to happen with classical information. Okay, so because this probability isn't 1 in this case, maybe it's not quite as sharp as the GHZ setting. But it was the first example of what sometimes is called non-locality. And Bell's theorem, as a theorem, it could be basically the theorem that basically asserts two things, the statement and the statement. Now, what's the point of this? Well, there are different ways of looking at it, but I think Bell's original motivation was to prove that some quantum effects cannot be simulated by classical information. Remember on Monday, Mike Nielsen said that quantum mechanics is a framework in which you can express the physics of a photon or energy state of an electron or other things. And there's also a framework of classical mechanics. And one might wonder whether you can simulate quantum mechanics with classical mechanics, sort of the way that you would, if you have a Macintosh computer, but you need to run some Windows software, you can actually simulate Windows in a sort of higher level language. Maybe it doesn't always work, but I notice some Mac people are not happy with that statement. But in principle, you can, with software, simulate one system with another, and it would be conceivable maybe that you don't really need quantum mechanics, but you can describe all the rules of quantum mechanics by this very complicated set of rules of classical mechanics. And this is, if that were the case, then, this basically refutes that, because whatever you used, just using classical mechanics, you'd have this bound of, 75% in this case, and it would be impossible to simulate the 85%. And if you carried out this experiment, that could be taken, it's certainly not a proof of quantum mechanics validity, but maybe evidence that classical mechanics, proof that classical mechanics can't explain what's going on, and maybe some evidence that quantum mechanics might be of some validity. Although it's a bit tricky to carry out this experiment, I understand. I mean, you have to be careful about the noise levels and so on. Okay, so moving along to communication complexity. Communication complexity is about another kind of multi-party task where there are inputs and outputs, and there's some goal to get from the inputs to the outputs, and the question is, how does communication enter into the problem. So this is a model that was, Bell was a physicist, and now Andrew Yao was a computer scientist, who in 79 he introduced this this communication complexity scenario, which is the following setting. So now we've got, it's not the communication scenario, because we don't, Alice is getting n bits, as, think of that as her input, and Bob is getting n bits, string y, think of that as his input, and the goal is not for Alice to send her n bits to Bob, or Bob to send his n bits for Alice, but the goal is for them to compute some function of all the two n bits that are shared between them. And so for example, they might want to compute this equality function, which is 1 if the strings are the same and 0 if they're different. So they just want to know whether the two strings are the same. And the question is, what kind of resources do they require to do that? Now, if there's no communication at all, well, Bob will have no idea whether Alice's string is the same. So there's going to have to be some communication. And the question is, how much? Now, it's sufficient for Alice to send all her n bits to Bob. That will do it, because then Bob can just compare the two strings. So is that the best you can do for this problem? Any thoughts about that? It's not immediately clear how you could do better. And it turns out that the answer is kind of interesting, because if you only consider deterministic protocols, if they have to basically win every time, get the right answer every time, then n bits of communication are necessary. So the sort of trivial thing where Alice sends all her data to Bob is the best. But if you allow randomness, if you allow Alice and Bob to flip coins, then and you allow a small error probability, then only basically logarithmic number of bits are necessary. And the idea is for Alice to choose a key of a random hash function and to send the key as well as the hash of the string x to Bob. That's a logarithmic number of bits. And then Bob to apply the key to his string and see if the hash functions match. It would take more to explain it. Maybe it's not, that wasn't great for the physicists here, but since that's an interesting result about classical information, and given my time, I'm going to skip the details of that. But just note the difference that the ability to use classical randomness makes a difference in the communication complexity of this problem. Incidentally, Yao won the ACM Turing Award just this year, and it was partly for his pioneering work in communication complexity. It's a subject that's interesting in its own right. For example, a setting in which to understand hash functions and other things, because there are other communication complexity problems different from the equality problem. And it turns out that communication complexity also has an interplay with other areas of complexity theory, circuit complexity, and other things that pertain to the efficiency of algorithms. So it's turned out to be a very fruitful subject in classical theoretical computer science. And so a natural question is, what if we sort of endow this communication complexity setting with quantum information? So we can think about the same things we did before. We can say, well, we have the communication complexity setting with each of them receiving an n-bit string as input, but what if we allow them to send qubits back and forth instead of classical bits? Or what if we give them some prior entanglement and then have that hope that in conjunction with classical communication can give them something? Now, from what I said at the beginning about the communication scenario, those were really examples that maybe suggested that we shouldn't be too hopeful, because you can't use this to boost communication. If the goal is for Alice to just send all her data to Bob, then these won't help at all, these resources. But it's a different problem here, because the amount of information that Bob is acquiring is a lot less than n bits. At least in this case, Bob is just acquiring 1 bit. It's just the reason why it's hard is because of the way that one bit depends on the data that's distributed between Alice and Bob. The proof that you need n bits communication using any exact protocol is, it's a combinatorial argument. I didn't explain it, but it's... And I thought I would just say briefly about the formal model of this, because maybe these little cartoons are not that satisfying. This can be formalized. The communication, the qubit communication model, it can be viewed as a kind of a circuit, where if Alice is sending, let's say, 4 qubits to Bob, and Bob's sending 4 qubits to Alice, and then 4 back to Bob, then you could think of that a protocol as corresponding to a quantum circuit of this form, where Alice has her inputs, and based on those inputs, she can apply an arbitrary unitary transformation. She sends some of the qubits of the output over to Bob's side, and he applies a unitary transformation on all the qubits in his possession, and it goes back and forth again, and then at the end, Bob measures, let's say, the last qubit, and that's his output. So that's how you would sort of rigorously be able to define the model. Okay, so does quantum information help with communication complexity? Does it make a difference? And there's a simple example where it does. And it's not the equality problem, it's the intersection problem. And how does this intersection problem work? So this is another communication complexity problem where Alice gets an n-bit string and Bob gets an n-bit string. But now Bob is actually outputting an index from 1 to n. And what's going on here? Well, think of this string as being Alice's schedule, her appointment book. And so there are n days. And in each day, if she has a 0, that means she's already booked for lunch that day. She's not free for lunch. And if there's a 1, that means she's free for lunch. So she's busy on day 1, but on day 2, she's free for lunch. And Bob has his schedule. And suppose that they want to see if they can find a day when they can have lunch together, when they're both free. So day 1 and day 2 are no good because Alice is busy on day 1 and free on day 2, but unfortunately Bob is busy on day 1, or free on day 1, but busy on day 2. I don't know if I said that backwards. But day 5 is the day that works for them. So we can ask the question, well, what's the community? So in this particular case I've drawn here, 5 would be a valid output. So we can ask, how much communication is necessary to solve this problem? Of course, it's sufficient for Alice to send her whole schedule to Bob. N bits is always sufficient to solve a communication complexity problem. The question is, can you do better? Can we get sort of the logarithmic improvement as we got with the equality problem? And it turns out that you can't. It's going to be order N bits of communication, which means some constant times N, necessary for any protocol, even if it's a probabilistic protocol where they flip coins, and even if we say, well, it only has to succeed with probability 2/3. So this is a problem that actually requires, well, order n bits if you don't use randomness and even if you do. So this is a case where randomness asymptotically doesn't help at all. Okay, so let's look at the qubit communication model, where if we allow them, this proof is if they are only allowed to send classical bits back and forth. It turns out that I lost the slide. Here, I found it. Okay. The search problem I'm going to talk about soon. So it turns out that with quantum information, quantum communication, you can actually get it down to log n qubits. Log n, which is essentially, it's almost square root n. So you get a quadratic improvement. And that's with where the error probability can be any constant greater than 0. So it could be 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000. Okay, so there's actually a separation between what you can do classically and what you can do with quantum information. And how does it work? I'd like to explain the protocol, and it's based on the search problem that Alain Tapp talked about yesterday. And the search problem is where you have a database and think of it as a database that contains n bits. And you can access the database by making queries. So there's an operation where you input an index I, and you get the output, the value of the I entry, whether it's 0 or 1. And the reversible implementation is in terms of this kind of operation where you get I as output in order to make things reversible. And the actual value in the I position is XORed onto some bit. That's a gain so that things are reversible. And with this kind of query, it turns out that you, as I think Elaine explained, you have to make any classical approach, even if you use randomness and you only require success probability 2/3, you have to make order n queries. If you just randomly, if there's only one one and you just randomly query in various places, then, you know, chances are you'll get it, you know, when you get halfway, you won't have to go all the way through the database, just halfway through. Notation, well, and Peter Hoyer on Monday used this slightly different notation for gates, O sub x, and this sort of this basically is just another notation for this gate, where I'm just using this symbolism here to sort of highlight where the data is XORed. Now, if you allow quantum queries, if you allow the queries to be in superposition, so this query operation becomes a unitary transformation. I'll take this off. Then with Grover's algorithm, you can actually find, with high probability, you can find a one with only square root of n queries. How does this search problem pertain to this appointment scheduling problem? Well, the appointment scheduling problem is really a search problem where they're looking for a one, but they're not looking for a one on Alice's data or Bob's data. But you can think of this sort of data that doesn't really, neither Alice nor Bob have, but it's somehow implicit in Alice's and Bob's data, which is the bitwise AND of Alice and Bob's data. And these are the days when they're both free. And they're looking for a one there. So this is Alice's schedule and Bob's schedule. And then the bitwise AND of the two things, they're looking for a one. And, it turns out that if they could perform a Grover search, perform Grover's algorithm on this database, then they would only need to make square root of n queries. The problem is that neither Alice nor Bob have this database. So what do they do? Well, Alice could send all her data to Bob, and then Bob, from this data and this data, could compute this data. But that's n bits communication, so that's not doesn't really give anything very interesting. It turns out that with a little bit of back and forth communication, they can simulate a query on this database. And what they want to do is perform a query on the X and Y database. So this unitary transformation, this is a particular basis state that the input could be in. And these two qubits are kind of scratch states or ancillas that are not supposed to, they're there, but they're not supposed to incur any change by this operation. So they can't do this kind of operation, neither Alice nor Bob alone, but together they can do it, and this explains how. So basically the way it works is that Bob starts off with the data, with the input data, and he applies a Y query. Since Bob has Y, he can do that. Then he sends all these qubits to Alice. Now, how many qubits is that? The index is log n qubits, and then these are 3. So it's log n plus 3 qubits. He sends them all to Alice, and Alice has X, so she can apply the X query, and she can apply this Toffoli gate, and then she sends the data back to Bob, who can apply this Y query. And then, and as circuits, these compute the same function. Why do they compute the same function? Well, the last bit is supposed to toggle if the position at the ith position of this is a 1. Here, the last bit toggles if this bit is 1 and this bit is 1. And for this bit to be 1, it should toggle here and here. In other words, only if Y and X have a 1 in that position. And then these last two operations are just sort of a garbage cleanup phase. And as Mike talked about, the garbage collection process, why that, and mentioned that that's important for quantum algorithms, because otherwise it prevents interference from occurring if you don't clean it up. So with this amount of communication, I guess since there's a back and forth communication, it's this many qubits, logarithmic in n. And then Bob gets the data back, and he's basically, what's happened is an X and Y query has been performed, and then he can use that in the context of Grover's algorithm by just applying several of these X and Y queries. He needs to make square root of n of them. So the total communication is the number of queries plus the communication cost per query, which is order square root of n log n. Okay. So that's a setting where we have there's a separation in the communication complexity. I mean, quantum, we have some kind of dividend out of quantum information. We get an asymptotic improvement. Can we do better than quadratic? And, well, time is, I don't want to go too much over time, or over time at all. So forget this line here. And there's a result of Rand-Raz, which is probably the strongest result, where there's actually a situation where classically you need the fourth root of n bits of communication to solve a particular communication problem, which I won't describe, and where using qubits, it goes down to log n. And that's even if you allow small error probability. So this is actually a more stronger result than this one, a more interesting result. So this is a case where you get an exponential improvement using quantum information. Can you always get speed up or improve communication savings in using quantum information? No. There's this inner product function where quantum information doesn't help at all. So what's the inner product function? Alice has an n-bit string x, Bob has an n-bit string y, and they want to compute the inner product of the two strings in modulo 2 arithmetic. So that would be a bit. And classically, it's been long known that you need order n bits of communication, even with randomness. It's also the case that with quantum communication, there's no improvement. Okay. Now, Bell's theorem and these results about communication complexity are both settings where somehow using quantum information, you're able to accomplish some task with less information. That's clear in this case that you're saving communication, and in Bell's theorem you're actually reducing the communication to zero, where it would be positive in the classical case. Here's an example where that sort of straddles. It sort of feels like a variation of Bell's theorem, and maybe it also feels like a communication complexity problem. Maybe I'll leave this one here. So let's phrase it as we did with Bell's theorem by conjuring up a game. And so Alice gets an input X and she's supposed to produce an output A. Bob gets an input Y and he's supposed to produce an output B. But now X and A, these are not just single bits. X is an n-bit string. A is a log n-bit string. So A is a lot shorter than X. Y is n-bits. B is log n-bits. And there's some rules of the game. So first, there's a promise on the inputs. They can't just be arbitrary n-bit strings. And the promise is that either they're going to get the same n-bit string as input, or the Hamming distance between the two strings is n over 2, assuming it is an even number. Now, what's the Hamming distance? The Hamming distance is the number of bit positions where the strings are different. So this condition here means the two strings agree in half the positions and disagree in the remaining positions. Okay, but there are several strings that have a Hamming distance n over 2 away from any given string. Now, after the inputs are received, communication is restricted. What do I mean by that? Well, for now, let's say communication is not allowed, just like in the previous examples of Bell's theorem, and then I'll weaken that a little bit. And then, finally, let's define what it means for Alice and Bob to win this game. They will say that they win if X equals Y, if we're in that case, then their outputs should be equal. And if X and Y, if we're in the case where their Hamming distance is n over 2, then the outputs should be different. Now, if we didn't force the output of Alice's to be log n bits. If she was allowed to output an n bit string, this, and similarly for Bob, this would be really easy. Alice would just output x and Bob would output y, and if x equals y, then a would equal b, and if x is not equal to y, a would not equal to b. Then what makes this sort of not easy is the fact that they have to compress the information that they receive and still have this sort of respect the whether a equals b is consistent with whether x equals y. And it can be shown that with classical information, in order to guarantee a win, in order to win all the time, order n bits of communication are necessary. So asymptotically, it's not you can't do better than Alice just sending all her data to Bob. So that means that if you disallow communication, they can't guarantee a win. But even if you don't completely disallow them communication, but you say, well, they can communicate, but just not very much. They can communicate log n bits, or maybe square root of n bits, or maybe n over log n bits. Anything asymptotically smaller than n, even if you allow that much communication, they can't guarantee a win. But if you give them entanglement Bell states, well, if you give them log n Bell states, then they can actually guarantee a win with no communication at all. So there are two slants to this. The Bell's theorem view of this is that this is like another variation of Bell's theorem, but it's one where we've actually quantified the amount of communication that the entanglement is saving. Because Bell's theorem can be interpreted, I mean, the Bell's inequality can be interpreted as saying that if you violate this inequality, the communication has to be greater than zero, because you can't do it without any communication. But it doesn't say how much greater than zero it has to be. Whereas here we actually can say actually that communication has to be a lot, because the number of Bell states is only log n, whereas the number of bits of communication that you would need to violate the inequality is exponentially larger than the number of Bell states it's n. Okay, and so now the communication complexity slant of this is that this is a communication task that's maybe a variation of Yao's original setting, where because neither Alice nor Bob is producing necessarily a function of x and y. I mean, they're both producing several outputs, and it's just the relationship between the outputs that we're requiring. It doesn't exactly fit the scenario of Yao, but it's sort of similar in spirit. And this is one where entanglement is actually reducing the communication complexity from n not to square root n and not to log n, but to zero. So that's a lot of savings, I suppose. Zero communication is a I don't think you can do better. It's optimal. Maybe this is a good time to stop so we could have a few questions.